It's October 2003 at Steve Jobs' home in Palo Alto, California. Steve lingers in his backyard under the night sky after taking a long walk. He's enjoying a quiet moment before he goes inside, because he knows as soon as he walks into the house, things won't be nearly as peaceful. A week earlier, Steve was diagnosed with a rare form of slow-growing pancreatic cancer, and tonight he's made a major decision about his treatment. Against his doctor's advice, Steve has decided not to undergo surgery to remove the tumor. His wife, Laureen, has been pushing him to set a date for the surgery, and now he has to tell her that it won't be happening. Finally, Steve steps inside, where he finds his wife, Laureen, waiting for him.
How's your walk?
Good. I figured some things out. Steve knows Laureen is eager for him to undergo surgery to remove the tumor, but he needs to tell her that that's not the plan, and he decides it's no use beating around the bush.
One of the things I figured out, Laureen, is that I'm not going to have the surgery.
What are you talking about, Steve?
I want to explore alternatives.
Laureen pushes Steve to think differently in his creative life. She knows that following his own path has led to some of his best ideas. But when it comes to his health, she would prefer Steve listen to the experts.
Steve, do you know how lucky we are that they discovered this so early? The doctor said with the surgery, you have a real chance of beating this. There is no alternative.
No, that's not true. I can attack it with diet, supplements, lifestyle choices. There are alternative healing methods to deal with pain, like acupuncture. Surgery, no, it's not the only option.
Dating back to his early days exploring Buddhism and Eastern philosophies, Steve has seen diet and healthy living as a major key to his success. He believes they can be a viable treatment for his cancer. But Laureen isn't having it.
That's magical thinking, Steve. It's not how cancer works. You have to go after it aggressively.
I think I've been running myself ragged. I think my immune system is battered. I just need to rebuild it.
Laureen takes a breath and tries a different tactic, one she hopes will get through to her husband.
Well, I know you're run down, but this isn't just about rebuilding your immune system. Remember, your body exists to serve the spirit. Your spirit can't be healthy if you don't take care of your body, and surgery is the only way you can do that right now. Well, Laureen, I've made up my mind. Have you spoken to Andy about it?
Steve's friend, Andy Grove, is a prostate cancer survivor. Laureen hopes Steve will take advice from someone who's been through this before.
Yeah, I talked to Andy, and he agrees with you. He thinks I need to get the surgery.
So your doctors, your friend, your wife, are all telling you the same thing, but you're too arrogant to admit that they might be right.
No, it's not arrogance.
Steve stops himself, and then his voice drops to nearly a whisper.
I don't want them to cut me open. I just don't want them to cut me open.
Steve rarely showed this type of vulnerability, even around Laureen. Moved, Laureen backed off her attack for the night. But in the days and weeks that followed, she continued to urge Steve to get the surgery. But no matter what Steve tried, he wasn't getting better. And in July of 2004, Steve would be forced to accept the inevitable. Surgery was his only option. Steve's surgery and his initial battle with cancer would force him to confront his own mortality. But staring death in the face wouldn't slow Steve down. Instead, it would inspire him to take big risks, lead his companies, Apple and Pixar, into the future, and cement his legacy as one of the most important business leaders and innovators in American history.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. On July 31st, 2004, Steve Jobs underwent surgery to remove the tumor from his pancreas. Steve told the people closest to him that the surgery was a success, and he told Apple employees that he'd be ready to get back to work after a brief medical leave. The surgery had been successful, but not long after, Steve learned that the cancer had spread to his liver. Steve started to regret his choice to delay the operation for so long. But his doctor said it was no use dwelling on the past. The best thing to do was to focus on how to proceed moving forward. Steve's doctor saw only one option, chemotherapy. This time, Steve did not argue. The chemo worked. Steve's cancer went into remission, and he started to feel like his old self again. During his treatment, Steve had kept his health issues as private as possible. But in 2005, Steve received an invitation to give a commencement speech at Stanford University, and he thought it might be worth sharing his story publicly. As Steve worked on the speech, he decided the young graduates would benefit from hearing the truth. On June 12, 2005, Steve stood in front of Stanford's graduating class and gave what many people consider to be the most honest, graceful, and inspiring speeches of his life.
Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
In 2005, Steve felt great. His cancer was in remission, but he knew there was no guarantee that would last. Steve took his own advice and decided to make big choices without fear of failure. He committed himself to accomplishing as much as he possibly could in whatever time he had left. Steve wanted to push Apple into new territory and create products that would revolutionize industries and change people's lives. And he wanted to make sure Apple and Pixar would be able to thrive long after he was gone. This is the fourth episode in our four-part series on Steve Jobs, Staring Off into the Future. It's late fall 2005 at Apple headquarters in Cupertino, California. Steve Jobs walks out of his office with a bounce in his step. He can barely contain the grin on his face as he heads for the elevator. Steve is going downstairs to meet with new Disney CEO Bob Iger, and Steve is excited. He and Iger work well together, and Steve's confident he can secure a long-term production deal with Disney that will help Pixar prosper far into the future. Steve steps off the elevator and spots Bob Iger waiting for him.
Bob, thanks for meeting me here. You mind taking a walk?
No, not at all.
Steve and Bob step outside onto the sprawling grounds of the Apple campus. Over the last several years, the relationship between Disney and Pixar has deteriorated. Former Disney CEO Michael Eisner refused to acknowledge all that Pixar had done for Disney, and to Steve, it seemed Eisner went out of his way to denigrate their work. Steve has grown to despise Eisner, and he's even threatened to walk away from Pixar's current deal with Disney when it expires in 2007. But Eisner is gone now, and Steve really likes his replacement. So how's Hong Kong, Bob? Bob has only just recently returned from the opening of Hong Kong Disneyland.
Well, the trip was illuminating, Steve. They did a retrospective at the park, and the state of things hit me. As the animation department goes, so goes Disney. And it's been years since we turned out anything worthwhile. Unlike Pixar, you guys have been on a bit of a run.
Since the release of Toy Story in 1995, Pixar has had a string of blockbuster hits with A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and The Incredibles. And Steve is confident their next release, Cars, will keep the streak going.
Well, Bob, we tried to tell Eisner that Pixar was leading the charge when it came to animated movies, but I guess he didn't want to see it.
Well, I see it. Hell, admitting that probably doesn't put me in a very strong negotiating position, but it's the truth.
Steve laughs. One of the things he likes most about Bob Iger is how straightforward he is.
Well, let's keep going. Let's just lay our cards on the table, Bob. Both of our companies can benefit from a long-term partnership. So let's do something big. Let's come up with a long-term production deal that puts both of us in a stronger position.
Bob stops walking.
Well, Steve, what if Disney buys Pixar?
Steve smiles. It is something he's thought about, but would never consider while Eisner was in charge.
Still, things are different now. Steve knows Disney needs Pixar, and he knows selling to a company as large and storied as Disney would give Pixar long-term security. Steve quickly formulates a plan.
Well, for it to really work, Bob, Disney would buy Pixar, but Pixar would need to run Disney's animation studio.
Well, it would solve a lot of problems for us, wouldn't it?
Steve has no intention of locking down Pixar's future if it doesn't include the people who have built Pixar to what it is, especially his good friend, animator John Lasseter, and Pixar co-founder Ed Catmull, who was a mentor to Steve when he first bought the company.
Bob, no one can do what Pixar's doing. Not Disney, not DreamWorks. If you want Disney Animation to return to its glory days, you need Pixar people running it. You need John Lasseter and you need Ed Catmull. And you need their teams to come with them.
Bob seems to love the sound of it. He knows Lasseter and Catmull are what drive Pixar, but it would be a huge deal. Bob knows it would take a lot of work to finalize.
Well, I think this is certainly something big, Steve. But I would have to take it to the board. And you and your team would ultimately have to make your case and win them over. Well, I'm confident we will, Bob. Trust me, once they hear from us, they'll want to ink the deal right there in the room. They always do.
Bob and Steve both left a meeting thrilled by the day's turn of events. Bob Iger met with his board and laid the groundwork for a potential deal. And Steve Jobs got John Lasseter and Ed Catmull ecstatic about the prospect of heading up Pixar under Disney's roof. And that was a good thing. Because soon, Steve, John, and Ed would be making a multi-billion dollar pitch to Disney, and their enthusiasm would help seal the deal. In late 2005, Steve Jobs, John Lasseter, and Ed Catmull met with the Disney board in Century City, Los Angeles. Steve talked about Pixar's history and how the company continued to be the nexus of art and technology. Then he handed the reins to John Lasseter. Lasseter brilliantly laid out Pixar's approach to movie making, and he mapped out how Pixar could help restore Disney to the top of the animated film world. By the time they left, Disney was all in. In January of 2006, Disney purchased Pixar for $7.4 billion in stock, making Steve Jobs Disney's largest individual stockholder with 7% of the company's shares. The small animation company Steve had initially bought for $5 million from George Lucas had grown into the most lucrative endeavors of his life. But just like with the sale of Next to Apple, for Steve, it wasn't about the money. It was about setting up his company for the long term and taking care of his people. As part of the deal, Pixar kept its own name and took charge of Disney Animation with John Lasseter and Ed Catmull at the helm. Steve was extremely proud of the new partnership. He said, "My goal has always been not only to make great products, but to build great companies. Walt Disney did that. And the way we did the merger, we kept Pixar a great company and helped Disney remain one as well." The sale to Disney would ensure Pixar's success long after Steve was gone. But even as he brokered the Pixar-Disney deal, Steve never lost sight of his first love, Apple. He had started holding weekly brainstorming sessions with Apple's top minds. For Steve, there was only one topic worth talking about: the future. At a meeting back in 2005, Steve had told his team at Apple, "The device that can eat our lunch is the cell phone." At the time, the iPod looked unstoppable and was responsible for 45% of Apple's revenue. But Steve saw a world where that could all come crashing down. Steve had watched the evolution of the cell phone along with everyone else. He pointed out to people that when cell phones added cameras, the digital camera market took a nosedive. He knew that if cell phones added music players into the mix, the iPod could be next, relegated to the trash heap of irrelevant technology. Steve knew what he wanted to accomplish next at Apple. He wanted Apple to break into and completely change the cell phone market. Steve's initial plan was to partner with a major cell phone company and provide Apple's iPod capabilities on an already existing device, and essentially an if-you-can't-beat-them-join-them approach.
Steve had come to see the addition of music players and cell phones as inevitable, so he wanted Apple to be at the forefront. But the more Steve dealt with telecommunications companies like Motorola and AT&T, the more frustrated he became, and the more he realized he hated the cell phones currently on the market. As was often the case with Steve, when he saw a product he couldn't stand, his first instinct was to create one of his own and make it different and better than anything out there. Soon, Steve couldn't shake the idea of an Apple cell phone. One day, he marched into a meeting with his product developers and proclaimed, "Let's do it ourselves." To get the ball rolling, Steve and the developers brainstormed ways to improve the cell phone. That led Steve to the idea that Apple's next creation shouldn't just be a phone. He imagined something that would be three revolutionary products in one: a cell phone, an iPod, and a mobile device that harnessed the power of the internet. He would call it the iPhone. Everyone on the project believed the iPhone had the potential to be the most significant product Apple had ever created. But initially, they struggled with a design that would provide the easy user experience Steve always aimed for. But one member of the team had a game-changing idea. Apple's chief design officer, Johnny Ive, had been integral in the success of the iPod. Now, 5 years later, he would help make the iPhone an even bigger triumph. Johnny and his team had been working on something called multi-touch. It was a burgeoning technology that allowed trackpads on devices to register multiple points of contact, two or three simultaneous finger touches, instead of just one as they had in the past. But Johnny's team wanted to push multi-touch capabilities beyond the trackpad. They wanted it to work on a screen. Johnny knew that if they could pull it off, multi-touch technology would allow users to make phone calls, send text messages, search music, and access the internet on the iPhone without the need of a keyboard, click wheel, or any kind of external tool. It would turn the user's finger into a stylus. When Johnny showed Steve what he'd been working on, Steve simply replied, "This is the future." Apple's other developers agreed, and soon the iPhone started to take shape. Throughout 2006, while working on the iPhone, Steve said he was having the most fun he'd ever had in his career. He was also feeling great. His cancer was still in remission, and he seemed to have boundless reserves of energy. Steve reveled in working late nights with his team to bring the iPhone to life. And as 2007 approached, Steve counted down the days to the iPhone launch. He was confident it would leave people absolutely stunned, and he would be proven right. On January 9, 2007, Steve Jobs took the stage at the Macworld conference in San Francisco. He told the crowd that he'd spent much of his career trying to create products that made the world a better place. He believed he'd done that with the original Macintosh and its subsequent iterations. With the iPod, Steve said Apple transformed the music industry. But in Steve's mind, the iPhone had the greatest potential to change the world on a large scale in a short time. He was ready to show everyone that Apple was ushering in the future of technology, media, and culture.
Well, today, we're introducing three revolutionary products of this class. The first one is a widescreen iPod with touch controls. The second is a revolutionary mobile phone. And the third is a breakthrough internet communications device. An iPod, a phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
The iPhone hit stores in June of 2007, and it took consumers and tech insiders by storm. Some writers even started calling it the Jesus phone. Within 3 months, Apple sold 1 million of them, and over the course of the next 3 years, Apple would sell 90 million iPhones that accounted for over 50% of the profits made in the entire global cell phone market. Steve had once again marched Apple into new territory and revolutionized another industry. But he wasn't done yet.
Following the success of the iPhone, Steve wanted to push forward and create Apple's next big thing. But Steve's body rebelled against him. In early 2008, his cancer returned and began to ravage his liver. Doctors told Steve the situation was desperate and that he needed a liver transplant. Despite doctors' warnings, though, Steve wanted to keep working. But soon the press and his own board would make that nearly impossible. Throughout 2008, questions surrounding Steve's health would make him a target for the press and start to affect Apple's bottom line. Steve would be forced to put his dream for Apple's future on hold and accept a difficult fact. He was running out of time.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the winter of 2008 in the backyard of Steve Jobs' house in Palo Alto, California. Steve is restless, pacing back and forth. This place usually calms Steve down, but today he can't relax. His cancer is back, and he's waiting to hear when he'll receive the liver transplant his doctors have told him he desperately needs. But that is not what's upsetting him right now. Steve wants to keep working, and he wants to keep his battle with cancer private, but both of these things are becoming impossible. Over the course of the year, Steve has lost 40 pounds. His appearance has caused speculation about his health in the press, and that's proven bad for Apple stock. The board is growing concerned Steve is now doing Apple more harm than good. So Steve calls his longtime friend, Apple board member Bill Campbell, to vent his frustrations.
Hey, Steve. How are you feeling?
Steve ignores the question and gets down to what's on his mind. The press are vampires. They want blood, man. All I see are articles questioning the state of my health. Why isn't the board doing more to push back?
Well, the press doesn't trust that they're getting the truth from us anymore, Steve. And really, that's not unwarranted.
Throughout 2008, Apple has released statements regarding Steve's health, but none have admitted that his cancer has returned. They blamed his weight loss on everything from a common bug to a hormone imbalance. Tell the reporters my health is none of their damn business.
Yeah, it's not just the press we have to worry about, though. Shareholders are concerned, too. They see these articles questioning your health. They see your appearance. Our stock's taken a hit. We're down to 97. We were at 188 in the summer.
You're insulting me. I know where the stock is.
I'm not trying to upset you, Steve. But these are serious issues for the board.
Steve collects himself. He knows what Campbell is getting at. And he's well aware that some members of the board think it would be best for him to step down as CEO. But Steve still has too many things he wants to accomplish before he'll do that. I still have things I want to do at Apple. Products I want to create. Huge projects that I know will be great for the company and for the people who buy them.
Well, no one doubts you still have brilliant ideas, Steve. No one questions your commitment to Apple.
I don't want to step down as CEO. I know I have it in me to get more done with whatever time I have left. Campbell takes a breath. He's torn between being a board member and being a friend.
Well, look. I would never ask you to relinquish your title, Steve. But as your friend, I want you to get well. I want you to focus on your health.
Steve doesn't respond immediately, and Campbell doesn't press the issue. They sit in silence for a moment as Steve weighs his options.
I could take a medical leave, release a public statement that I will remain CEO, but that Apple will be in steady hands while I'm away. But I want to make it clear that I'm not finished yet. I'm confident my health issues will be resolved, and I'll be back to work soon.
Well, I think that's a good plan. Certainly good for Apple. And it's probably good for you.
In January of 2009, Steve officially went on medical leave, but he promised he would be back at Apple soon. With the help of his wife, Steve would make good on that promise. In 2008, while Steve continued to work, Loreen took it upon herself to get her husband approved for a liver transplant. The process was complex and at times frustrating, but Loreen was determined to see it through. When she pushed Steve to get surgery after his initial cancer diagnosis, Steve pushed back. But this time, Steve put all his trust in Loreen. It was a smart decision. Loreen got Steve on transplant lists in both California and Tennessee. And in March of 2009, they got the call they'd been waiting for. Steve had made it to the top of the list in Tennessee, and there was a viable liver donor for him. As soon as they got the news, Steve and Loreen immediately flew across the country for Steve's potentially life-saving procedure. On March 21, 2009, Steve underwent a successful liver transplant at the Methodist University Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. But during the transplant process, doctors discovered that the cancer had spread even further. Still, after a series of medical treatments, Steve bounced back. His cancer went into remission, and he started to recover his strength. By May of 2009, Steve was ready to get back to work. He looked better, his energy had returned, and he was eager to dive in. Once again, staring death in the face spurred Steve to work even harder. He understood his time might be limited, so he wanted to keep pushing Apple forward. This time, he knew exactly how he wanted to do it. Steve wanted Apple to create a tablet computer, one that would blow away the products that were currently on the market. Steve was certain they could take what they had learned on the iPhone project and use it to create what would come to be called the iPad. Steve envisioned the iPad as a more relaxed product than the iPhone. He saw it as a new way to read books, peruse the daily news, and search the internet. Steve wanted the iPad to be a product people could curl up with on their couches. The design and engineering teams rallied to their leader and quickly embraced Steve's vision for the iPad. They utilized the screen-based multi-touch technology they'd developed for the iPhone and the sleek, thin design that had become Apple's calling card. Steve loved it. He claimed the iPad was easier to use than anything Apple had ever designed. Steve was thrilled to bring Apple's tablet to the public, and once again, consumers shared his excitement. Apple's first iPad launched publicly in April of 2010. In the first month, Apple sold 1 million devices. And within 9 months, that number rocketed to 15 million. The iPad was moving even faster than the iPhone, and Steve was flying high. He was so thrilled by the public reaction to the iPad that he immediately started looking for ways to improve it. Steve envisioned an iPad 2 with front and back cameras, a case that better highlighted the screen, and not surprisingly, an even thinner design. But in late 2010, as Steve threw himself into the development of the next iPad, his cancer came back. Once again, Steve was confronted with the reality that he was running out of time. In the fall of 2010, Steve had tried to ignore the fact that something was wrong, and he continued to push himself at work. But soon, he couldn't deny that his health was failing. Steve struggled to finish his neighborhood walks that had become part of his regular routine, and his appetite all but disappeared. During the development of the iPhone, Steve had felt like he could work all hours of the day, but now he felt tired. He started to fear the worst, and when he met with his doctors, they confirmed those fears. The cancer had returned again, and it was spreading. Steve underwent a series of treatments that drained his energy even more. Despite that, he still wanted to keep working as much as he could. He felt like it was important for him to have something to fight for every day, and he wanted to see the iPad 2 come to life. But Steve had lost even more weight, and speculation regarding his health once again fueled newspaper articles and online gossip. The last time his health became headline news, Apple stock had taken the hit, and Steve didn't want that to happen again. In January of 2011, Steve Jobs again took a medical leave, but held on to the title of CEO. He still wasn't ready to give up on the idea of coming back to Apple someday, and he made it clear that he wanted to be kept up to date on the progress of the iPad 2. Steve had come to see the iPad 2 as possibly his final contribution to the Apple product line, and he wanted to see it soar.
He stayed in touch with his designers and developers, and he followed the iPad 2's progress closely. Johnny Ive and others were happy with the improvements the new version had made over the first generation, and Steve was happy too. He told his friends and colleagues that he would be at the special launch event in March to introduce the iPad 2 to the world. Some of his friends tried to dissuade Steve from participating, though. They said it wasn't the right thing to do for his health, but Steve wanted to be there. It wasn't just about the iPad. Over the course of his career, Steve loved getting up in front of the Apple faithful to talk to them about the company's latest products and evangelize about how he saw the future. Apple employees were the ones who cheered his triumphant return in the 1990s, and they were the ones who energized him when he'd launched so many successful Apple products over the years. Steve wanted to get up on stage and talk to his employees one last time. So in San Francisco, on March 2nd, 2011, he did. That day, as Steve stepped out on stage to introduce the iPad 2, he was greeted with thunderous applause and a standing ovation. He was 50 pounds underweight, gaunt and in pain. But that didn't slow him down, and it didn't lessen his enthusiasm.
Thanks for coming. Thank you. We've been working on this product for a while, and I just didn't want to miss today. So thank you for having me.
After the launch of the iPad 2, there were moments when Steve convinced himself that he could still be part of Apple's future. But reality would quickly hit him. In 2011, as Steve's health continued to deteriorate, he would use the time to look back on his career. He would wax nostalgic with old friends and even old rivals, and he would finally accept that he'd run out of time. But even as Steve saw the end approaching, he would never fully take his eye off the future. And up until the very end, he would continue to push those around him to innovate, move forward, and try to make the world a little better.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
It's May of 2011 in the living room of Steve Jobs' home in Palo Alto. Steve slips on a sweater over his black turtleneck and reclines on the couch. He's horribly emaciated, so the sweater seems to swallow him whole. Steve is cold, shivering, and in pain, but today is one of the good days. He has some energy, and he's excited to sit and talk with his longtime rival, Bill Gates. Steve's daughter, Eve, greets Bill and leads him into the living room. As Bill takes a seat, Steve gives him a once-over and grins.
Saving the world looks good on you, Bill. I don't think I've ever seen you this relaxed.
Over the last several years, the rivalry between Steve and Bill has largely faded. This is due in part to the fact that Bill has stepped away from day-to-day operations of Microsoft to focus on the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, his nonprofit organization committed to fighting disease, poverty, and inequality around the world. Unfortunately, Bill can't return Steve's compliment.
How are the treatments going, Steve? It's kind of like jumping from one lily pad to the next, trying to stay ahead of the thing that's chasing you.
Well, you sound good.
I feel good. Just old.
Starting to think we might not be the young guys in the business anymore.
Bill laughs. There was a time in the 1970s when he and Steve had to fight just to be taken seriously by the old guard. Now, both in their mid-50s, they're seen as ancient by most of the tech world.
Larry Page from Google called me, Bill. He asked if you could come by and get advice on how to be a good CEO.
Did you tell him to leave you the hell alone?
Well, I wanted to. But a lot of people helped me early on. I figured I should do the same.
Well, should I call the press? Tell them that Steve Jobs has gone soft?
Steve and Bill laugh again, and they go into a series of stories about the good old days. Then they spend time talking about their families. And after close to 3 hours of conversation, Steve knows he needs to get some rest.
but he doesn't want to let Bill go without talking about the future.
Bill, for everything I've done, I can't stop thinking about all the stuff I won't do. Oh, you can't get bogged down in thoughts like that. It doesn't bog me down. I want computers to do more for education. I want people to have more access to the best technology. I want to see more products that can have real impact on the world.
But we'll get there, Steve.
Yeah, but I won't be there to see it.
Steve, you played a huge part in whatever comes next. Whether you get to see it or not, you pushed everything forward. I know we wouldn't have done half of what we did at Microsoft if you and Apple hadn't been forcing us to look forward all the damn time.
Well, you're welcome.
It's true, Steve. Yeah, you did everything you possibly could, and way more than most people ever do.
Bill sees Steve droop and can tell he's tired.
I should head out.
Yeah, it was great seeing you.
Bill stands, but he stops before leaving.
Hey, Steve, I know complimenting each other is it's not really our thing, but indulge me with one more. Because I think you did incredible work at Apple. You saved it from the bozos when you came back.
Well, thanks, Bill. You did some good things, too.
Steve smiled as Bill headed out of the living room. The two of them had known each other for over 30 years. Their friendship and rivalry had shaped modern computing, defining the technology industry for decades and giving rise to two of the most highly valued companies in history. For better or worse, Steve and Bill would always be linked in the eyes of the industry and much of the world. While they may not have ever been the closest of friends, Steve's relationship with Bill Gates was one of the defining aspects of his career. And Steve was glad they had gotten to spend a few more hours together. That was the last time Steve and Bill ever saw each other. And the next few months would bring Steve a series of similar farewells. Not long after Bill's visit, Steve's health declined even further. As much as he wanted to go back to work, by late summer of 2011, it was clear it wasn't going to happen. On August 24th, Steve returned to Apple and took part in his final board meeting. Steve didn't have the strength to walk to the boardroom, so he arranged for someone to take him there in a wheelchair. Steve remained quiet for most of the meeting, but as it wound down, he read from a statement he'd prepared. "I have always said if there ever came a day when I could no longer meet my duties and expectations as Apple CEO, I would be the first to let you know. Unfortunately, that day has come." In the fall of 2011, Steve told his wife, Laureen, he knew his life was coming to an end. The two spent as much time together as they possibly could. Sometimes they talked about the past, but often they just sat and enjoyed being by each other's side. Then, when October arrived, Steve felt something change, and he seemed to know he was down to his final days. Those close to him said it was like he'd switched his focus from anything that might be happening in the outside world to his impending death, and he wanted to make sure everything was taken care of. He spoke to Laureen about his funeral arrangements, and he reached out to people he loved in order to say his goodbyes. On October 3rd, Steve called his sister and told her to get to his house in Palo Alto as quickly as she could. He wanted to see her one last time. And the next day, he told Johnny Ive and some of his closest colleagues at Apple to come by the house too. Later that evening, Steve struggled to breathe and he could barely talk. Steve knew it would be his last night on Earth. His wife, children, and sister gathered around him. Steve was happy to spend time just looking into the eyes of the people he loved. Then, at one point, Steve's gaze shifted, somewhere beyond the people gathered around him, and he spoke, "Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow." With those words, Steve Jobs slipped out of consciousness. News of Steve's death on October 5th spread quickly. All newscasts around the globe broke into coverage to let the public know that one of the world's leading innovators had died.
We're able to report, unfortunately, that Apple is confirming that Steve Jobs has passed away after a battle with pancreatic cancer.
In the distinctive style that made it such a powerful brand, Apple informed the world its 56-year-old founder had died. Writing on the company website, it had lost a visionary and creative genius, and the world has lost an amazing human being.
As the public got word of Steve's death,
people flocked to Apple stores and turned them into makeshift shrines to pay their respects to the man they believed had helped change the world.
Just some simple flowers outside this Apple store here, and who would have ever thought that a store could turn into a shrine? But it's representative of the emotion we saw overnight. Everyone from corporate kings to kids, all saying that Steve Jobs changed lives and changed life.
After Steve's death, retrospectives and articles attempted to sum up his legacy. But the true impact of his life and work would prove difficult to fathom for years to come. Less than a decade after Steve died, Apple became the first American company to ever be valued at $2 trillion. And Pixar, in its home at Disney, remained at the forefront of animated movies. But Steve's legacy is far more than just the success of his companies. The products Apple produced under Steve's leadership became such a cultural force that it's almost impossible to unravel the full scope of their influence. This led tech writer Glenn Chapman to state plainly that Steve will be remembered as one of the rare few who changed the world. One of Steve's biographers, Walter Isaacson, suggested that Steve belongs in the pantheon of the greatest American business executives who ever lived, alongside the likes of Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. Those who were closer to Steve tried to put his legacy in more personal terms. In 2020, when asked to describe how he saw his old rival, Bill Gates said, "Jobs was a genius. No one else could have done what he did at Apple. I couldn't have done that. I don't know anyone who could have." And Johnny Ive, the man who Steve called his spiritual partner at Apple, said he would want Steve to be remembered as a man who truly believed it was his duty to create beautiful, simple products that benefited society. But of all of Steve's colleagues, his longtime friend John Lasseter might have come closest to truly defining Steve's legacy. For Lasseter, what Steve left behind was the ability to always look forward and to push those around him to do the same. As Lasseter had witnessed firsthand, Steve always believed the future could deliver the next big thing that would change the world in ways people couldn't possibly imagine. In 2013, John Lasseter accepted the Disney Legends Award on Steve's behalf. The award honors those who have made an extraordinary and integral contribution to the Walt Disney Company, and Disney wanted to celebrate Steve for bringing Pixar into the fold and restoring Disney animation to its former glory. At the ceremony, John Lasseter spoke, often fighting back tears. He recounted his personal and professional relationship with Steve, and he told a story about pitching his idea for the short film Tin Toy to Steve. He talked about showing Steve his storyboards and artwork for the film. Then Lasseter summed up how he would remember Steve Jobs best. In pure Steve Jobs fashion, Lasseter kept it simple. He said, "Steve was looking not at the drawings on the board that I was pitching. He was staring off into the future." Next on Business Movers, Rick Tazzelli, co-author of the New York Times bestseller Becoming Steve Jobs, gives an inside look at what drove Steve Jobs, what stood in its way, and how he was able to mature as a leader. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 4 of The Enlightenment of Steve Jobs for Business Movers. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Steve Jobs, we recommend Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent Schlender and Rick Tazzelli, The Business Wisdom of Steve Jobs, edited by Alan Ken Thomas, and Steve Jobs in His Own Words, edited by George Beam. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Michael Federico. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, Dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.